Mini episode 838 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 836. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris here. And I have to say, back on the show with us, one of my favorite guests over a period of time, and that really covers a lot of ground when you look at some of the folks that we've had on the show and some of the people that I've enjoyed talking to repeatedly. When you got guys like Bob Barker and Kenny Albert and some of the ones that we've been fortunate to have on repeatedly on the show here, even wrestling legend Lex Luger, one of my faves. I'll put this guy right with him. A gentleman of many, many talents, whether it be column writing, providing opinions on TV, book writing, we'll be talking about that certainly, and providing all kinds of political analysis really on any kind of platform. The great Ellis Hennekin. You can find out everything that's going on with him presently at Hennekin.com, and the most prominent of projects right now, a book that has just been released, Tuesday's Promise, One Veteran, One Dog, and Their Bold Quest to Change Lives, co-authored with the late Luis Carlos Montalvan. And it is a true pleasure to have you back on the show, Ellis. Thank you so much for coming back on with us, and congratulations on this great new book.
Hey, Rick, always enjoy hanging out with you, man.
I right back at you. And, you know, we were, I'll never forget getting to do this in person a couple of years ago back in Tribeca. You were kind enough to have me up there at your place personally when I was in town, and really enjoyed that sit down with you. And every time we've gotten a chance to do stuff subsequently, and as I say, you're a man that's always got your finger in many pies. I can relate to that personally. And this book that you've got out, really being released today as we're taping this, and so it's just hit the shelves there for people to be able to order. Great subject matter. Anything with PTSD and veterans, that's a topic that is always kind of shamefully undercovered in the media. And hopefully this book will do a lot to spotlight that issue and what people are doing to kind of adjust as they get back to society and find new ways to beat their problems.
Well, Rick, like a lot of people, I mean, it's something I've been aware of for a while, you know, especially since we had such large numbers of people coming back to civilian life after Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, I knew a lot of these guys were having trouble and, you know, a variety of different challenges they had. So I teamed up with Luis, who is an interesting character. He is a captain in the U.S. Army, so an officer, won the Purple Heart across two combat tours in Iraq, you know, real active soldier, macho guy. When he gets back home after his second tour, he is he's a mess. You know, he's got such fear and anxiety. This tough warrior can literally barely leave his apartment. He is so racked with nervousness and discomfort. His life is in a lot of turmoil until he gets paired with this golden retriever service dog named Tuesday. And man, these dogs are amazing. I got to tell you, this particular animal, not only could he follow a couple of hundred commands after 2 years of training, but literally, when Luis was just on the verge of having one of his meltdowns, that dog would come over with its wet nose and his warm breath. He just had a way of making Luis calm down and get his confidence back. And these two spent the past 8 years wandering America, helping other veterans and battling with the VA. They managed to get Congress to pass a law providing veterinary care for military service dogs. And you know, they were on the Letterman show. I mean, they really became two of the most effective advocates in the country on behalf of our military veterans.
It's amazing the things that can happen with animals in this way, Alice, in something that seems a little bit kind of similar to me, a good friend of mine has become involved in a project. Unfortunately, in my home state of Ohio, we are sort of the epicenter of this nationwide opioid epidemic. And a friend of mine, yeah, it's a horrible thing. A friend of mine has gotten involved in a program. I don't know if you've heard anything about this kind of thing or not. Equine therapy for heroin addicts and others who've had issues like that. It's something about being around the horses and having to care for them and basically to sort of get on the same wavelength as them. It sort of does a little bit of rewiring of your mind, and it sort of focuses you in a new kind of way. That it's a way of sort of bringing you around psychologically to make you more open to things that can be more positive in your life. And it almost kind of seems like the service dogs do kind of the same thing. It almost seems like there's something about the presence of these very special animals that's able to sort of do a little bit of necessary rewiring in there and help heal some of these people who've got such very bad trauma.
Yeah, man, I love hearing about that. In the case of this dog, the Tuesday, he was initially trained in prison. They sent him to prison.
Wow.
And the service dogs get raised in their early years by prisoners, in their early months. And then they go with a family, you know, who take them out in the world and get them used to cars and shopping malls and, you know, trains and all that kind of stuff. And it is amazing. They're doing it. Used to be, you know, we had seeing eye dogs, but that was about it. But now, yeah, these dogs are working with, you know, people with various psychological issues, kids with autism. They're having a lot of success with autistic kids. So you're right. I'm not sure that I can really fully explain it. I'm not sure the experts really know why it works. All they know is that somehow those animals are able to reach people in a way that sometimes other people can't reach them.
Yeah, it's really valuable when something like that can happen, when you can have these kinds of breakthroughs and discover ways to help people that really have problems that seem to be, in a lot of ways, kind of intractable. And I know that, again, this has been an issue that it dates back further, obviously, than the Iraq War, but it's something that's more in the forefront these days than it was, say, in the 80s and 90s, because we're fresh off of these wars and people coming back and dealing with these issues. And it's a thing where, you know, as you have noted, the average of about, what is it, like 20 vet suicides per day, just a horrible thing. Yeah, a horrible epidemic that we have. The best and the brightest of our society, people have given up so much to go and fight on our behalf. And unfortunately, as the story goes here, this is something to which Luis was not able to get past himself in the end either. A great story, though, it is, obviously, everything leading up to that point. But this is just something where, again, it's going to take a lot of force of will, and for as much as every time we get a new administration in office, it seems like there's always talk about doing stuff with the VA. I mean, I could think of no bigger priority personally with the VA, even for as much as there always is in the way of bureaucracy and people suffering from lack of care. I would think that these mental and psychological health issues have got to be number one by far, I think, in terms of addressing better.
Yeah. Well, you know what? If you add up people who have what we call the invisible wounds of war, you know, these various psychological effects of trauma, that's really what it is, right? We put these kids through some kind of horrible trauma, and it affects them as it will. We have more people suffering from that than we do of the traditional wounds. You know, some guy who gets his leg blown off or gets hit with the shrapnel and IED, those are absolutely terrible and you know, something that deserves the attention they get. We have more people suffering from the psychological impact than we do from the physical. And anything I can do, whether it's, you know, write a book or do an interview and talk about it, and I know a lot of your listeners are, you know, concerned about that or know people who are like that. We just need to open our minds. First of all, we got to admit there's a problem. Then we got to open our minds about the different ways to solve it. But I got to tell you, if you want to get inside the head of somebody who's dealing with that and learn some, right, both some hopeful aspects to it and some parts of it that are just really frustrating. You know, there's nothing I've ever produced that's the equal of this one. I'm very proud of it. Tuesday's Promise, it's called, and it's, you know, it's in bookstores across the country and Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you know, wherever the books are sold. So I appreciate your focus and a little attention on it, Rick. I really do.
Well, thank you, Ellis. I'm glad to get to talk about it. And again, I think really doing the Lord's work here and shining a spotlight on these issues and showing why, again, and it's a thing where it's easy to talk about an issue with this and sort of, you know, veer towards a lot of people will veer towards the political in ways that they shouldn't. But I think it's a thing here too that for folks like myself, again, I'm certainly on the right side of the spectrum, but really sort of define myself as a realist internationally, particularly in light of some of the debacles that we've had here. Again, there's no do-overs when it comes to wars here, but if nothing else, one would think that, again, the human tragedies that have befallen this country for the veterans in the wake of Afghanistan and Iraq. Again, Afghanistan was something we couldn't really run from, at least initially, after 9/11 happened. But Iraq, certainly a war of choice. It is something, obviously, for policymakers, I think, to keep foremost in their minds, Ellis, the human cost of these things and the things that just go on for decades and decades after the last bullet is fired.
Yeah, you know, that ought to be something, honestly, that unites people, whatever their politics are. You know, once we send those people, those men and women to war, most of them young men and women, once we send them over there, you know, we really need to take responsibility for what happens to them. Whether they're in favor of the war, opposed to the war, liberal, conservative, I don't care. They went over there to do a job for us. And I think we bear responsibility to get them back on their feet and help them begin living productive lives. And, you know, that's just, listen, that's just part of doing business in the big bad world, I think.
Oh, it is, absolutely. And that is something that should be an issue that unites everyone across all stripes, no question about that. And, you know, on a somewhat lighter note here, as regards and anything with Trump, when you're talking about that, because of the entertainment specter, is going to be a lighter note than this kind of stuff. But, you know, you're a guy, Ellis, you're so intellectually honest in how you go about stuff, and I think that's one of the reasons that you have been on platforms as much over a period of time, like for example Fox News, because you're a guy who can go on there and give your perspective and be fair about it and everything. I wonder, to this degree, in looking at Trump being president, and again, there's a lot, everybody on the right side of the spectrum like myself sort of gets saddled with this. I'm personally in the caucus of, don't blame me, I voted for Darrell Castle as I went on the Constitution Party line, but is there any kind, as you look at this, of compassion for your friends on the right side of the spectrum in terms of, like, what if it was President Jerry Springer that was a Democrat and you were out there having to defend some of the policies he was putting forth? I wonder, based on your knowledge of Trump, your background all this period of time, if you're not just kind of laughing, shaking your head a little bit sometimes at some of your friends on the right and going, oh, those poor guys having to defend some of this stuff.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's absolutely right. And you know, I mean, I've bounced around this, you know, pundit world long enough, but I have personal friends, you know, all different political views. In fact, you know, all the years I spent at Fox, I mean, I'm pals with lots of pretty staunch conservatives. You know, what happened when Trump came around, and it was interesting, a lot of the people that I think of as kind of the first string conservative pundits, you know, I'm thinking about people like, you know, S.E. Cupp and, you know, Will Cain, my friend Monica Crowley. A lot of them had real trouble with Trump. Rich Lowry, another example. You know, and so I think that early in the game, the Foxes and the CNNs and the NBCs had kind of I don't want to be rude about it, but kind of a second-tier group of people on TV defending Trump. Like people who would never have been there in the first place if it were a regular Republican or conservative candidate. So they kind of had to scrape the bottom a little bit, I think, with some of these folks. And it made the thing, you know, it's put a whole spin on it. I mean, listen, look at Sean Spicer. There's an example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a guy who's got an almost impossible job.
Right.
Right? He goes out there, he's got to defend stuff, he's got a boss. No, the boss, Trump, is yelling at him. Saying, no, just get out there and say it. Say we had the biggest crowd on Inauguration Day. Look, I know we did. They're lying. And so Spicer, right, he's in the kind of impossible position. The reporters are giving him holy hell. The boss is yelling at him. They're making fun of him on Saturday Night Live. I mean, yes, a part of me thinks like, oh, man, poor guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, in terms of your colleagues that you've had, past and present, I want to pass along my condolences here. I know that you were a frequent fill-in for Alan Colmes, and I never got a chance to meet the guy, but a great human being from everything I ever heard, and I know that his loss is felt very deeply by his friends.
Yeah, no, that is true. And that also, I think, cut across the political spectrum. I had both the honor and the duty to, you know, fill in for him a bunch in the days when he was not doing well near the end. I did a memorial show that, boy, it was amazing how many folks gathered just wanting to talk about the guy. You know, honestly, Rick, it's one of the things I like about what you're doing there, is that I think it's boring just to talk all day with people that you agree with.
Sure.
You know, I mean, there's nothing more boring on TV or radio than the guest who says, good point. Good, you know, you got nothing else to say after that. It's much more interesting when you kind of mix it up a little bit. You know, you bounce ideas off of people. You know, that's how we learn. So I've always liked talking with people who have a pretty big diversity of views.
Absolutely. I can really relate to that. And as a big Rand Paul fanboy, I find that, again, I usually find something to differ with and whoever is on the program at any given point in time. So I hear you.
You know what I think, Rick?
What?
In my case, I think it comes from being from a big, loud family. You know, I got, believe me, like my liberal friends always ask me, like, you know, how can you stand the touch of that O'Reilly guy? I'm like, come on, he's just like my uncle, you know. It's like talking to my relative. Except in my family, when we're having those debates, everybody's drinking, so it's a lot harder than going on with a sober blowhard on Fox. Believe me, I just feel like I'm back home, man.
Sure, I can understand that, and I had a question to ask about some of the things here. And you're perfectly positioned to answer this, being a guest on many of these shows, particularly O'Reilly over the years, and again, being an analyst of the media. But it's been kind of a weird thing to me as we're looking at Trump's first 100 days, at the people that didn't survive it in their present jobs. Bill O'Reilly goes from interviewing him on the day of the Super Bowl to everything kind of blows up, he's gone now. You look at Milo, the alt-right guy, he was kind of riding high there for a while. He ends up getting bounced out of Breitbart. Tommy Lahren, looks like her 15 minutes of fame might be up. But I was looking at this. I was looking to see if there was any kind of an analogy to when Obama came into office. And right about that point in time, it seemed like some of the same kind of stuff was happening. That was the last days of Air America. You got Keith Olbermann, who's somebody where, you know, Mother Teresa would have punched him in the nose. But all of a sudden, that becomes an issue at that point in time, right? It just seems like, you know, your moment in the sun almost kind of stops once, quote-unquote, your guy gets in there. Is that a function of today's culture?
That's ironic. That's an interesting insight. I hadn't really thought about that, but I think you may be honest. One thing I would add, though, the people that you mentioned, Milo, O'Reilly, I'm not sure they're done.
Right.
Tommy. I mean, these are people who, you're right, they've had some kind of a tumble. You know, they've lost their immediate platform.
Sure.
But media is a big world. You know, if Romney wants to do some new network, or he wants to do something online, if Tommy finds some other home, if Milo is just starting some kind of some kind of hit squad or something. You know, I'm sure I'll be one of his targets. But I don't think these guys are, I don't think they're dead yet. I mean, Keith Olbermann is still kicking around, for God's sake.
Right. No, that's true. That's a good point. And this is a media landscape where everybody kind of gets a chance to redefine themselves and go to new platforms and try new things. And you are absolutely right about that. It's just jarring.
Listen, it gives me hope. If I really screw up somewhere, maybe get a second and a third
act. Yeah, exactly. You know, there is always a lot of hope when you look at that and how people are able to reinvent themselves. It was just striking to me that there didn't seem to be any kind of notion that anybody was going to have to reinvent themselves, because these were, as far as it goes with O'Reilly, Milo, and Tommy, in very different ways, three very different people, but three people that all were very strongly identified with the Trump tide, if you want to call it that, and none of them make it out of the first 100 days on the present platform that they're on. So it's an interesting thing.
You know, let me add one other thing. You got me thinking here, man. Mm-hmm. One other thing I would say, it is in many ways easier to be in this role, you know, the pundit role, the columnist, the commentator, the critic, when your friends aren't in power.
Yes.
You know, it was a whole lot more fun for me, honestly, to, you know, be banging on George W. Bush than it is to be saying, well, you know, Bill Clinton's not that bad, you know, I mean, it's not, you know, it's a lot easier. It's a lot easier to be, you know, taking shots from the outside than it is to be ducking fire coming at you. So, in a way, like right now, the energy is kind of on the left, right? All these, demonstrations over the health care plan and all this resist stuff, you know, in the same way that when Obama was in power,
yep,
most of the energy really was on the right. So yeah, in terms of commentary and criticism and media stuff, in some ways it really is easier when your guys aren't in power.
You're right about that, because everything with the resistance out there right now really reminds me, as it reminds a lot of people, this is not an original insight on my part, of the Tea Party, the early days of the Tea Party, and the protestations against the new administration that's in there. And some of this in today's polarized world is sort of the nature of the game. Some of it is just sort of special to the circumstances of it. And the circumstances of somebody like Trump, and this is where, again, I want to burrow into your insights as somebody who has covered the scene that has included Trump now for a couple of decades. I want to know what you think on this one here in terms of culture shock. Bigger culture shock. Is it Donald Trump adjusting to Washington or Washington adjusting to Donald Trump?
I think probably the second.
Okay.
Because I don't think Donald Trump is adjusting to Washington. I think we'd be better off if he was more open to kind of learning how to get stuff done, learning what the culture is down there, learning how to, you know, to some extent, to achieve things, you do have to play certain games. I think he's probably just too old to learn much new. So I don't think he's changing, but he's definitely forced a lot of changes on the world and on the culture. He's doing stuff, you know, love him or hate him, he's definitely doing stuff his way.
He certainly is. There's no doubt about that. He is an American original, whatever else anybody else might say. But
you know, it's funny. I'm working on I just agreed. We'll talk about this maybe when it comes out, if you're up for it.
Yeah.
I just agreed to write kind of a funny book about Trump, like a little paperback, like a little bathroom book. And it's gonna be called Trumpitude. And it's gonna be like how to behave like Trump. You know, how to. It's like the little white book or the little black book of, you know, how to be just like Trump. And like how to pick a wife like Trump picked a wife. You know, and we'll have a whole bunch of tips. Maybe some of you folks can give me some suggestions. But little things that you got to learn, like here's what I was playing with. Like, pick a wife who speaks enough English to follow your directions, but not so much that she expresses a lot of her own opinion.
That's perfect. As a matter of fact, you know what this is putting me in mind of? A very Donald Trump-like character, the more I think about it. I never made this connection before. The book Sterling's Gold that came out of Mad Men, I'm getting the sense that that's the kind of book you're going to be writing here. Something like The Wit and Wisdom of Roger Sterling. It sounds a lot in that vein. That would be awesome.
it's just going to be funny. It's not like a serious. It'll come out before Christmas. It'll be like, you know, more of like a little stocking stuffer book. But keep that word in mind. You got to the right Trumpitude.
Trumpitude. Awesome. I definitely want to have you back on when that's coming out to talk about that. That is definitely certain. I want to ask you also here, too, in terms of looking at this, you mentioned Clinton before. Part of covering the scene over a period of time like you have is that you've seen the ebb and flow of scandals. We saw in the first 10 days of the Trump administration echoes of the Saturday Night Massacre with Sally Yates getting shown the door for defying the orders of the president. All this stuff that's going on right now with Russia, again, a lot of it is going to get down to the nitty-gritty in terms of what the intelligence community finds, who did what, the things that you and I don't know yet. But just in terms of looking at the political climate of scandals, this is a thing where, again, people in the first month or so were convinced that he wasn't going to last beyond that stuff there. It started to turn a little bit subsequently, but what's your sense of where this thing might be going? He's certainly a man who does not have anything on the Republican side in the way of impeachment insurance and Mike Pence, because most Republicans in Congress would probably rather have Pence as president. So could be like a Jimmy Carter type situation there when he had Tip O'Neill knifing him in the back and vice versa. So what's your sense of where the Russia thing might go, at least on a political level, and how that might affect his longevity as president?
That's two questions. Let me see if I can answer one. The Russia thing, I think there's more that we don't know yet. I mean, I believe, and I can't prove it yet, but my interest is mostly watching how people are reacting. Tells me that there are more connections, maybe not with Donald himself, but with some people pretty close to him, some connections with some Russian actors that are going to be embarrassing when they finally come out. And they will come out. They believe me. The FBI and the other investigators will get to the bottom of that. They're not there yet, but they're going to get there. So I think there is more pain. Now, I don't think this is going to end well, but I got to tell you, I still don't know how it's going to end. Impeaching the president is very difficult, particularly, you're right, when your own party controls the House and the Senate. They're not eager to do it. I don't have the sense that he's on the verge of impeachment or anything like that. And we know from Clinton, even impeachment doesn't necessarily do the trick. If you had to take a bet, I mean, I think it's just going to putter along with a new scandal every day, a new tweet every hour, you know, a new firing every week. I just think the turmoil, we're in kind of a permanent state of turmoil. Rick, it may be bad for America, but it'll be good for people like me and you. We'll have an awful lot to talk about.
Absolutely, and good for your ongoing column that you've got going on in the Metro newspapers and being able to talk about Trump and covering Trump's America and drawing upon your decades of covering him. And again, I had alluded to this off air in terms of your time as an author. Two subjects you'd written about, I wanted to pick your brain about vis-a-vis current events here. Of course, with the book that you had done, subsequently, in the blink of an eye, Dale Daytona and the Day That Changed Everything, the book with Michael Waltrip. In terms of your knowledge of NASCAR and of the scene, I wonder if you have something of the same sense that I did kind of coming into this year, and if you've heard anything from whether it be Michael Waltrip or anybody else in NASCAR. I was a little bit concerned with this whole three-stage thing they started doing this year. The idea was they wanted to eliminate folks, you know, hanging back, and all these things are basically to pump up the ratings, and I think they basically admit that. And my thought was, at least at the restrictor plate tracks, and again, you having written about Dale Earnhardt, there you go. You know the dangers of those. I'm thinking to myself, boy, that could be really bad if you're encouraging people to be more aggressive at Daytona and Talladega. Lo and behold, last weekend you had the big pile up there. Unfortunately, it looks like everybody's going to be okay. But have you gotten any sense from anybody in NASCAR that there might be a little bit of actual danger to this in terms of encouraging people to be that much more aggressive?
Well, no, you put your finger on a very key question. First of all, for folks who don't know, those two tracks that you mentioned, Daytona and Talladega, have very banked curves.
Yes.
So the speed with which the drivers can operate, the aggressiveness, and their ability to just come whipping around those curves is much stronger than on a flatter track, and so it encourages a more aggressive style of driving. I mean, you have to go back to around the time of Dale's death. We're talking, you know, 2001 in that era when they put in these Hans devices, which protect the head and the neck in the case of an accident. It really did make racing safer. But one of the dirty little secrets about car racing is that one of the reasons people are there is to see a wreck. You know, it's the most exciting thing. It's the time where there's true risk and danger in the air. And ratings have been down a little bit over the past few years. And there is a lot of pressure, particularly from television, who wants those numbers. Even if people are turning out of the track, however many people tune in on television, it's a big part of the income in this business. And so I think that you put your finger on an explosive little issue there. There is a desire to make the races more exciting. The Ricks left a long return. You know, golf may be the only thing that lasts longer.
Right.
And so, you know, they want to have something that isn't just, you know, 3 hours of loud buzzing in a circle. And, you know, are the drivers being put at risk in order to do that? Maybe a little bit, yeah.
I hope that proves not to be the case. And again, my perspective on this, again, we're all formed by our own experiences and perspectives. I speak from the perspective of somebody who had the great honor of having a conversation coming off of his second Indy 500 win with Dan Weldon. A couple months later, we know what happened there. So yeah, I get extra queasy at this kind of stuff, Ellis. You know what I mean? It's like ratings. I understand they're the lifeblood of the sport, as they are for all of these things here. Now and again, as a native of Cleveland and a lifelong Cavs fan, you know, certainly I understand the things that drive ratings, like LeBron James and NASCAR wrecks and all of that kind of stuff. But NASCAR wrecks have, of course, real world consequences, and I just hope those are being taken into concern enough.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Although, you know, some other day you and I could talk about the parallels in other sports. I mean, you know, football, are we given head injuries and brain damage to our football players?
Right.
As we shift from boxing into mixed martial arts, which is already happening, I mean, that's a very violent sport where those fighters have, you know, pretty short careers and take a pretty good beating. I mean, what does it all go back to the Christians and the lions, you know, that we may pretend to be civilized, but we really do enjoy some violence for our entertainment? I mean, those are tough questions, and I don't think it begins and ends with NASCAR.
Well, what I like about you is you're the kind of guy who really enjoys kind of chewing on these kind of things here, too. And as long as we're talking gladiator things, the other thing I mentioned that I wanted to get into with you having previously authored Home Team, that great book about the Saints with Sean Payton, and you being a big Louisiana guy and a Saints fan. I don't want this to hit too close to home as I ask this question here, because I know you're not just a fan, but a friend of the coach and a co-author. And again, I want to stipulate up front, I have no standing as a lifelong Browns fan to say anything about any other team. But I just
you and me both.
You know, well, exactly. You know, I look at this, and again, I wonder if you have any sense, or any sense you'd want to admit to, of just sort of a Groundhog Day state of affairs right now with this team here. I mean, I'm not saying bust a slug in Drew Brees while he's still performing at a high level, but as far as building around him, really rebuilding after those glory years, beginning of the decade, and it's just sort of been a trough for a couple of years here. I mean, do you have any sense, yeah, watching them as a fan, that things are going to be going in the right direction quickly enough to where Drew Brees can still perform, go out there and be the leader of a playoff-winning team? Or what's your sense? Because it seems to me they've just sort of been in that kind of meh zone for a little bit now.
Yeah, no, I think Sean and Drew will both feel it. I mean, my read on it is that it's more than Drew. I think his performance has stayed really pretty strong. And quarterbacks, as you know, the first of all, the officials have gotten much tougher about protecting quarterbacks. You know, the word is out on those defensive linemen that they're like, you know, you better not hurt the quarterback, or really bad things are going to happen. And so, you know, we're seeing quarterbacks with longer careers than we might have expected. I mean, Drew's numbers this past season are, you know, still, I mean, pretty damn impressive. I think the problems they've had really have been more with the defense and with the other positions, more journeyman positions than the quarterback. And I think you're right. I mean, it would be really nice, just in terms of the story of it all, if Drew gets one more championship season, if Sean is able to, you know, rally something in the next year or two, because, you know, eventually, listen, none of these jobs are forever. The fans and the ownership turn on you at some point. I mean, I believe Sean's a very talented football coach, and he probably won't spend the next 20 years with the New Orleans Saints. I mean, he probably has another couple of years there, and he's going to go somewhere else, but it would sure be nice if he left with his people in that great city with one more thing to cheer about.
Oh, yeah, that's the kind of coach that deserves to leave on his own terms. I can tell you this. You got an absolute steal at number 11 in the draft. I can say this, being a native of Ohio and Lattimore. That kid is a flat-out shutdown corner.
Have you
Have you followed him? I mean, I know people are pretty excited about it.
Yep, yep. I've been to – well, my dad's an Ohio State alum, so I get to a fair number of games because he's got season tickets. And I will tell you, congratulations is all I can say to you as a Saints fan, because he never should have been there at 11. That kid is locked down, man. That kid is going to do great things. Obviously, one position out of 11 on defense, but I think we would agree, when you're talking shutdown cover corner, that's in the top three or four defensive positions easily.
Well, listen, man, you're giving me hope. I didn't realize I was going to end this conversation on such an optimistic note. Let me say this, Rick. I hope you're right, man. You're right.
Well, and I'll tell you what, and I'll bring everything full circle on this. I'm going to take the obvious cheap shot about a guy on something that you said there. When you talk about defensive coordinators saying, you know, don't hurt the quarterback, I'm a big fan of the guy, but our new defensive coordinator, Greg Williams, I don't think that's what he ever is telling his players, Ellis.
No. Well, you and I have both had some experience with Greg. I think he's probably got pretty good skills, but he left a bit of a bad taste in New Orleans.
He did. He did. He's a character, much like many of the people we've had a chance to get into in this characteristically great discussion with you, Ellis. Again, as I say, you're one of my favorite guests. There's just so many things that we can get into and talk about, and it was a pleasure to do all of that. And I wish you nothing but the best for this new book, Tuesday's Promise: One Veteran, One Dog, and Their Bold Quest to Change Lives, co-authored with the great Luis Carlos Montalvan. Thank you so much for your time, Ellis. And when the Trump book's coming out, we got a reprise.
All right, man. Good to be with you. All over the map. Have a good one.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Ellis. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for this mini episode of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.